something like this. Is that okay?
That's great.
Yeah, okay, cool. I'm just going to turn this off.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Wombat Radio. Today we're speaking with Ben Landau, and we are at one of the sites for his Next Wave piece. Maybe before I say any more, you can introduce yourself and the piece. Set sure. Some foundation.
Sure. I'm Ben Landau, as you said. and this piece is called Algorithmic Misfits, where groups of small audiences, they don't have to be small people, just five people at a time, walk around Melbourne City to a few different venues to meet with several experts in internet privacy. So the content's about digital rights and internet privacy. And we're in one of those sites now.
Cool. Are they performing being experts? Or are some of them experts? I guess they become experts.
Well, actually, they are experts in their own right, but they're not technological experts.
Mm.
So actually, when I met a lot of the technological experts in preparation for this show, and still when I meet tech people,
yeah,
they go crazy with jargon and you can't get lost pretty quickly. Yeah, right. So actually, I teamed up with technical experts and other specialists in like philosophy, marketing, political science, and one technical expert, and these like technical people, and they help kind of like talk around the technical issues. So they are kind of experts in their own right.
I guess privacy is super broad concept.
Mm-hmm.
Like their book, A Brief History of Nearly Everything, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the author's name, but he was talking about when houses were single rooms, and it was the invention of the door that came along, like brought with it the invention of privacy.
Yeah, I think it's actually internal walls was the big change, because families used to live together in one big room and even share like one bed, and then there was like the rich people started having dividers and having their own rooms, and that kind of trickled down into commoners, and they started dividing off into rooms. And that's another big invention in the history of privacy, is the change from not reading aloud. So because literacy was kind of, I guess, exclusive, and only people who were educated or in religious areas were literate. They read and they shared what they read by reading aloud. As more people became literate, they also read in their head. And this, they say it was a big change in the idea of privacy, because you could have your own thoughts and in your own head as a difference to reading aloud.
So the analog version of telepathy.
Well, I guess they would still have had their own thoughts in their head, but I guess the fact of just not having to read it out loud meant that you could have a lot of people reading in one room together at the same time, whereas before it would have been very loud and hard to listen to one person.
Yeah, I wonder about movies that have subtitles. The subtitles are in the same language as the film itself, and you can't really stop yourself from reading and listening. That's a weird thing. It's like it's simultaneously accessing two different aspects of
the content.
Yeah, of the content. Or like ways that it can affect you. Things have some weird extra validity when they're in writing. I guess because they're so explicit. Words are so explicit.
I find it, my girlfriend's French, so I find it funny when we watch French movies, and I'm learning French slowly. But when you, like when there are sayings or idioms and how that's translated, or how sometimes there's a long sentence in French and then at the bottom it just says no. I think those translations are funny as well. But I mean, I don't have the benefit of seeing both sides, but I know what you mean. But I think, in terms of this show as well, there's also these kind of subtexts where people have to kind of read between the lines of what is an expert or what is the truth, because actually in these connections or meeting sessions with these experts, they're also get different perspectives. I mean, there's one person who has a strong marketing perspective and tries to highlight the benefits of targeted advertising, and a lot of the things that we take for granted in terms of being online, in terms of being shown what we want to see, whereas some of the others are quite negative and about that aspect, saying that it's limiting our perspective, whereas I think if our perspective was unlimited, we may never find actually the things that can actually help us.
Yeah.
So there's, two sides to the same coin kind of thing, I guess, and they show that they're different perspectives.
Hmm. What have you found out about the differences between secrecy and privacy?
Well, they're definitely not the same.
Hmm.
I think it's the same. Well, everyone says that they have nothing to hide, but really, we close the curtains at night. We wouldn't want to have cameras in our rooms, inside our homes. Julian Burnside makes a reference between CCTV and having spies on every street corner, or saying that how many domestic violence cases occur in Australia every year could be solved by putting cameras in every home.
Yeah.
And basically that would catch everyone, but who would want to do that? So also there's the issue of, I guess, in terms of having nothing to hide, that you may yourself may not have anything to hide, but you also may want to protect the ability for people who are kind of skirting close to the edge of having something to hide, like whistleblowers or journalists, of needing to protect their own privacy.
Yeah.
And I guess where privacy and secrecy comes into contention as well is the idea of mass surveillance and targeted surveillance.
Mm.
And in the show, we give people tools to resist mass surveillance by putting apps on their phone or ad blockers or using encrypted email. But in terms of, I guess, protecting against targeted surveillance, as you would have in terms of, I don't know, ASIO or the NSA or the police or whatever, there's not much you can do. Like, really, it's quite... We're not looking at that at all in terms of trying to keep things secret when you are the target of surveillance.
Yeah,
it's a different kind of matter. So we're not equipping terrorists, as some people have said. I think even if we were, the tools against mass surveillance are out there and easy to find.
Yeah.
But the tools against targeted surveillance are more tricky and not as foolproof as the ones for mass surveillance.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's also that funny thing that what is illegal is not always what's wrong. Because legality comes down to power rather than justice or fairness.
Definitely. So, and one of the speakers also talks about the idea of surveillance, and his question to the audience is, are you a good person? Which is from the questioning technique by some cult leader, I can't remember his name, or maybe he's... Maybe not so much of a cult, but he, by trying to define whether you're a good person or not means by, whose measurements, and therefore are our measurements in line with what the government's measurements are. And he makes a connection between the idea of the all-seeing God, which was strongly prevalent in society up until only like 100 years ago or something, maybe not so much today, or the comparison of an all-seeing God who can see everything that goes wrong and that you do, that's wrong or right, and judges you accordingly, with a government who is all-seeing in terms of tracking your metadata or seeing you on cameras, or even with systems like Five Eyes or Prism, started by the NSA, to really go deep into what you're actually doing, looking at all of your private information.
Mm. Yeah, even South Park has an episode where the NSA, Cartman's trying to work out how the NSA is tracking everybody. How do they possibly have this information? And so he infiltrates and gets a job there, and then eventually discovers a room where Santa Claus is hooked up to everything, because Santa is the all-seeing purveyor of justice and fairness for gifts. And so Santa and the NSA are replacing God as the all-seeing eye about when you're being naughty and nice.
Yeah, well, I think South Park hits the nail on the head more more often than
stuff. What about, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, so you pronounce it right, surveillance, where you're not, there's not an authoritarian figure, but you are surveilling each other at all times and recording that.
Yeah, well, I mean, we are doing that mostly through social media. And that's kind of an obvious answer in some ways.
I even think about dash cams. Because I got a hard time from a policeman a couple of weeks ago about a blinker that I didn't realise had blown. But he didn't tell me it had blown. He asked me if I wanted him to defect my car. But I didn't have my dash cam running to be able to report. And then do you really want to, like... It's one of those things. Like, someone's conduct, if it's caught on camera, people act better on camera.
There's... have you read the book The Circle by Dave Eggers? There's a concept there where politicians and other public figures, they go transparent, which means they basically hang a camera around their neck at all times and anyone can log in at any time to see them. But yeah, I mean, the fact that there's so many devices out there, listening devices, optical devices like cameras, that should be able to be turned on and off or watched. Actually, we had a symposium last night where one speaker, Adam Molnar, who looks at surveillance and law, was saying that the law hasn't really caught up with technology in terms of in the way that police don't need a warrant to be able to tap microphones or optical devices like cameras, as long as they can do that without a warrant if they don't need to go into your house. They can also put a GPS tracking device on something as long as they don't need to go into your house. So the house is seen as the, I don't know, the center of privacy that you can't go past without a warrant. But really, in today's age, the privacy could be your devices or your files or your cloud or whatever, really. So these laws are really outdated. So the fact that they can also tap optical devices like the camera that's pointing at us right now on my computer, or either the microphones in our phones, or the I mean, you're recording this anyway.
I'm recording it. But if this recording fails, we'll just have to contact someone and they'll have
under freedom of information. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, there was also proof recently, although Facebook denies it, that they use your microphone to record conversations and then use that to target advertising to you. So there was like a 60-year-old man who tested this by discussing pregnancy and babies and kids and stuff, and he started getting ads for nappies on his Facebook feed.
Wow.
So a lot of these apps as well are surveilling us and the people around us. Facebook denies that, but people have done kind of like these tests that maybe are not so scientific, but to me, you know, convince me, even as hard as it is to believe, that we are being kind of surveilled. That's, I guess, more corporate surveillance.
Yeah.
That's the two sides that this show also falls into. Algorithmic Misfits falls into is more kind of corporate surveillance, Facebook and Google, online, and then the other side is government surveillance, which is on the internet but also through other kind of digital means.
I wonder if we're really, if one beneficial outcome is the dethroning of God, because if God was seeing everything but now our authority sees everything, and then following that we all see and record everything. And if also what you were just talking about, I lost my train of thought. What else does God provide? I guess it provides what you're asking for, answers your prayers.
Yeah, or eternal advertising. A heaven kind of thing, I guess.
Yeah, the kind of the promise of eternity also happens through the recording of your actions while you're alive. So God kind of passes judgment and is all-knowing, but also offers eternity as the salvation of that judgment. And now surveillance is replacing that, and surveillance will replace, hopefully.
That. Hopefully?
Yeah. Well, I'm a big fan of letting go of God.
I don't think I ever held on to God.
Well, we're in a lucky position that that was a choice to us in the first place, I guess.
True. Yeah, I think the big difference as well between surveillance and surveillance is, or the issue is, of it being a, I guess, a citizen-led movement or a centralized movement of taking care of you. And that's what, I guess, both corporations and governments suggest, is that by, well, governments more, I guess, by looking after you, they also looking, you know, at everything you're doing, they are making society safer. So it's not an eternal bliss or heaven or something that happens after you die, but rather making society safer now. And that's a kind of like a bit of a hollow promise. And actually surveillance does, mass surveillance does very little to make our society safer. I think there was a study done in Germany, I think, which found that the introduction of scanning metadata and retaining metadata meant that there was like 0.001% less crime or something ridiculous. And to date, I think with the NSA, there's only been, with the NSA's kind of tapping of all of your communications online through Prism, looking at all of your actions on the internet through Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, eBay, all of the big companies. They've only caught one guy who I think was transferring like $8,000 to ISIS from somewhere in Iowa or something. So they found, they caught one guy. So all of these billions of dollars of surveillance and interrupting people's privacy only really caught one person.
So I think that's going to get, because at the moment that still has to be viewed by and acted upon by human-led authority organizations. But I imagine the end point is an artificial intelligence that, like full Judge Dredd style, takes like notices and takes action and passes judgment.
Well, I guess there are two sides to that. The side is the passing judgment, and the second is taking action. So passing judgment already happens through algorithms, which I was talking to, again, Adam Molnar last night at this symposium, and he was saying he talks to his students about the kind of algorithms which, when you book a flight, and the certain things, that the tick boxes that you have, how long you book it before you leave, how your name, your background, where your passport's from, whether you choose a regular meal or a halal meal, all like create like these red flags in these algorithms, and how that can mistakenly identify someone. And so they, I guess these algorithms are programmed by people who make these decisions, but it's it's where you can misidentify. Exactly. Oh, definitely.
And ignorances of their own.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah.
But not only these prejudices are, you know, wrong to have, or but they also sweep up the wrong people as well, and people get caught up in them. So that's, I guess, the decision-making process. And a lot of these algorithms that make decisions either from a governmental stance or from a corporate stance are making incorrect assumptions all the time. And secondly, in terms of taking action on these on this data, I guess there are I guess drones which are manned by people, but they go and bomb people, and the head of the NSA say they have killed people on the basis of metadata.
Wow.
That they have I guess trialed someone without a trial, you know, they've decided that someone's a bad enough guy from their activity, from their email and phone activities, so much so that they've decided to kill them.
Is it usually men?
the people they kill or the directors of NSA?
Both.
Oh. Yeah, I have no proof, but yeah, I would say it's...
Seems like it.
Seems like it's always men, yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, well, I would suggest that most of those leaders of the NSA or spy organizations would be men.
Mm.
Yep.
It's interesting approach that maybe you can shed some light on where with, say, more people are going to get on the bandwagon with geoengineering than with a reduction in climate impact, because that lets us continue to do what we're doing, which is throw more technology at something.
Mm.
And I also, I guess maybe this is the question, do you think that people are going to have faith in the improvement over the long term of algorithms to a point of artificial sentience beyond prejudice? And people will get on board with just throwing more technology at a broken system until it works, rather than like deciding that we've gone the wrong way.
Well, yeah, that's a big question.
Yeah. Lots more questions on Wombat Radio.
I feel like someone will... That, I mean, AI will be developed regardless of whether it's a, you know, a good thing or not.
Yeah.
That the forces behind it are driving forward either because of power or money, or that these things will happen. Mm-hmm. And we've just, I guess, got to try and put in place laws or guidelines, kind of, I guess, ethical boundaries that try and lead us in a direction which will work out the best for humankind. Mm. Like, for want of a... But, I mean, I...
But then hopefully also non-humankind as well.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the next step on the...
Yeah, there's a that's lot the of next step. That's,
I mean, I'm not really an expert in this field. That's okay. So I... but I feel like, as we've seen so far, we make prototypes of things to test them out before we know that they function properly. And we're always testing things and seeing how things go wrong. And big companies like Facebook or Google can make small changes in the back end that we don't see, that we're kind of always being tested on, and then always have these kind of these feedback loops of, oh, we tried this and this ended up like this. Okay, let's try and switch this around. Okay, how does this affect this? And as you said, these are always backed by their own prejudices or biases or commercial interests. And this also comes out, for instance, in how Facebook, among other companies, can have their own like political prejudices in the way that they back Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders, or how they probably also have an impact on Australian political arena. And they're recently had stories that came out how the programmers there had sort of suppressed more conservative news in favour of more, I guess, liberal or left-wing news. Mm. But those prejudices also come from the company that's running it, but also within your own feed, either on Facebook or Google News or whatever, is prejudiced by what you already know and like. So there's also those impacts. So I guess there's both the system that runs it and the user, which impacts kind of what they see. And the creators of these technologies, which have a lot of money and power, and you can see that the way big kind of corporations like Google are investing in everything from green technologies to driverless cars to robotics to biotech, means that they're getting many fingers in pies, and their ethics are driving development in those areas in a way that will be beneficial to them. And that slogan of Google's of don't be evil comes into question.
Yeah, because as we said at the start, that's totally a socially agreed upon set of principles that changes and shifts in different societies and different cultural groups. And
yeah, but there's like those agreements can't catch up with technology, I don't think. No. And that's the worry.
Yeah.
And that the ones developing it, the speed that's required of feedback or growth or to get results happens a lot quicker than anyone can decide whether it's actually a good idea or not. Whereas if in the past maybe it was developed by governments, they might have put, or maybe not, might have at least tried to work out if something was a good idea. I mean, we saw, I guess, with the development of the atom bomb in the Second World War and how that resulted, but we're still arming ourselves with nuclear weapons, even though we don't hear about it.
And submarines.
Yeah. Yeah, true.
I think it's a weird thing that you can make something for a purpose and put it out into the world, and then it gets used in a way that you didn't intend. And so your non-evil intent has facilitated what you may think is evil. But then, of course, the people using that thing that way would not think it was evil. I'm sure Twitter was supposed to be updates, but now it's become actual legitimate news source. Snapchat seems like it was always about sending incriminating photos, but it actually, I listened to an interview with the dude that wrote it up, and he was like, well, things don't have to last forever. If you just want to show someone the cool diet, the cool picture of the frothed image that your barista's put on the top of your coffee, you don't want to, like, you don't go to the shop and print that out and give it to them so that they can cherish it. You just want to show them like you would if they were sitting next to you in a moment that is, momentary and fleeting. And that was his intention behind Snapchat in his interview, apparently. But yeah, everyone's like, great, boobs. I'll send you a picture of my boobs. And so there's a weird and complicit nature of adoption as well.
Yeah, well, I don't think you can hold on to any technology that you develop. No. I mean, you can't say, I've developed this bomb, but you can only use it for good, not evil. Like, I mean, that's an extreme example, but I...
No, well, even plumbing. Someone develops plumbing, but you can only plumb buildings that are doing good for society. You can't plumb buildings that are like...
Are you saying plumbing because you're looking down on construction?
Well, I just think...
I mean,
Dr. Carl on Triple J often says that plumbing is the turning point of when a village becomes like a city and a town, when you're like going camping and when you're living in what has become civilization. The difference really is plumbing.
But then again, if you've got a camper van with one of those yes. temporary toilets to have to empty out your own shit, sometimes I think you're kind of devolving.
Yeah. Yes. It's true.
Yeah.
I just think there's a lot of shiny technologies. Like even the toilets that are really prominent in Austria and a little bit in Germany that have a shelf so that you can look at
shit
and before it goes away. There's like that as a design and technology that undermines your privacy.
Well, I think...
there's like shiny digital privacy, but there's a lot of versions of technology that are not in code.
Yeah, definitely. But I would say that, I mean, it's not that... I mean, I guess the history of the toilet as well is looking at your shit used to be the way that you would tell if you were sick or not and what you were sick with.
Yeah.
And there are... I can't remember which king it was that died mysteriously, and they looked back on the records of his shit checker.
Whoa.
And they thought that actually he probably had this disease because he had, a low count of red blood cells, and so he had really dark shit or something.
Amazing.
So the shit checkers
were,
you know,
really
kind of like...
the king down.
They really let the king down.
That's his metadata there.
That's exactly right. So, you know, you had to, like, your shit had to hang around a little bit for you to be able to check it out. So maybe that's why those toilets were designed like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, of course, in all technologies, not just shiny technologies, there's prejudices.
Yeah.
Like Bruno Latour also talks a lot about the door closer, the automatic door closer, and how that, you know, allows and prevents certain things, certain people coming through, or negotiates that space in a different way as well. Something as simple as a door closer. And, you know, all technologies in their development have changed in a way. Like, I know at the Architecture Biennale in Venice, maybe 2 years ago, when Rem Koolhaas and OMA divided architecture into, I think, 15 elements, and of like door, window, balcony, floor, ceiling, and bathroom or toilet was one of them, and analysing all kinds of different toilets through the ages and what toilets are today, what they've been, and what decisions and how the decisions that architects make influence how they're used, or the different kind of prejudices and morals, ethics that that architects have, and how they come out in their designs, and in a, like a, I guess in a more technical way, the people that came to the symposium on privacy last night, one of the speakers, Robin Doherty, he runs these crypto parties which give people access to technologies, like people like you and me, so we can install apps on our phones and use encrypted email and all this kind of thing. But he also runs crypto hack sessions, which try and give technologists, people who are developing software and systems online, more of an ethical basis for what they will and won't do in terms of data. So it's just like, I guess, architects might be taught principles to avoid being prejudiced against certain people or conditions or actions, and in a similar way, technologists need to he says that there's no kind of ethical code or boundaries for technologists, and he's trying to kind of develop that in some way.
Cool.
For programmers, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how as it seems like people are the inhabiting force, and their buildings and what they make of them and how they divide them and how they allocate different parts of them are really clear, visible, physical manifestation of how they're interacting through the world and who they are, and if they have a bidet or not, or if they have a one of those food chewers in their sink or not, or how much space there are for bins under there. Sink, if there's a compost and a recycling, or if there's just one bin, and all of those things are built in to enable and allow and facilitate default actions that result in a better or worse outcome. But that kind of design, user interface design, and metadata retention and application is so less visible.
Yeah, definitely. And that's the thing that comes up in a lot of the discussions that we have is, like, some people leave these sessions saying, oh, well, you know, it doesn't feel like it's affecting me. So I think if there was a physical or visual way that you could see how much your, like, for instance, your phone, how much information that's giving off, sending off into the atmosphere, then you would maybe have a bit more reluctance to having it at you on all times, or showing what you're sharing, or that kind of thing. And this invisibility, you know, we don't know what we don't know. We don't, you know, not by not seeing it, it's not there.
Yeah.
I have a program on my computer called Little Snitch.
Yeah, I got one.
And that shows you all of the kind of connections, uploads, downloads that your computer makes with on the internet.
Yeah.
And it's amazing seeing how many times your computer is accessed. I mean, I don't know the technical side of it, but making that visible, having an alert pop up every time something happens, helps to show that, yeah.
Funny reason. The funny thing is, the reason that I downloaded Little Snitch was because I couldn't afford to use a certain high-end design software at the time, and so I pirated it. And Little Snitch was letting me know when it was trying to validate its use, because it had a 30-day window or whatever, when it would work for me.
Okay.
And then, of course, you know, it was a short gig that was unpaid and someone just needed something done for their show. So art validated illegality for me. But it's interesting exactly that, like, what you use which parts for. There's another one that I use as a Chrome extension. I forget what it's called. But it shows you a graph of every site you go to and all the reach outs that it does.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's got a D as its
I don't know that one.
Maybe not. But it's very the data visualization is very beautiful and impactful.
Yeah.
Rather than reams of numbers and letters. It's like it's almost as if every hand you shake, you suddenly have those other 12 people that hand is then shaking in front of you, like showing you that they've just sneezed into their hand or whatever it is, what other shit you're going to be picking up.
There's a company called, there's several like data brokers. One of them is probably one of the bigger ones internationally. It's called Axiom, and they can collect data from all everywhere. Well, they've been collecting data since I think the 60s.
Wow.
And they basically started by taking different public records and cross-referencing them and kind of, I guess, as computers came along, kind of digitizing them and trying to build profiles of different people.
Wow.
And this is what politicians can use to target sort of swing states, or companies can use to work out the best area or the best people to market to, in a similar way to flyby cards, start to give a profile about what you buy. And with these technologies, they don't necessarily have to. I mean, targeted advertising is just not on the internet. It can kind of be in different places. There was someone, Selena Nemeron, Dr. Selena Nemeron from Monash University last night, was talking about screens which actually have computers which sense your sex, your height, your background, certain things about you, which they then use to target advertise to you in the real world without you knowing. Maybe if you log onto the free Wi-Fi, say in Emporium, maybe that notifies the Wi-Fi about where you are in the center, and then they can sort of directly advertise because they know what shops you go into. She was talking about neuromarketing, which kind of has a marketing focus groups, but they don't listen to what you say. Instead, your brain is hooked up to EEG or fMRI, and they see what centers of your brain get stimulated by certain visuals or words, and so they can start to kind of match what you or people in your demographic put you into. And I know Axiom, for instance, has 70 types of people a column that they put you in.
Just in the Western world?
I think they're based in the States, so I don't know. The documentary I saw on Axiom was made in 2004, a series called The Persuaders, and that was really revealing. And I can only imagine what they've done in the last 12 years in terms of further targeting people. But I mean, a lot of the technologists I talked to as well said, they kept talking about Google and Facebook, but really it seems like they are the duopoly on the internet in terms of targeted advertising. Everywhere you see a Google Plus button on a website like on The Age, or a Facebook like button, that's like a pixel or a little a view into what you're doing. Even if you're not on Facebook, even if you're not logged into Facebook, they can connect that to your account or to your shadow account. If you're not on Facebook, you still have a shadow account, which if you overjoin, they'll already know stuff about you. So it's kind of like this huge profile building exercise, which means they can deliver both advertising and content to you, which further affirms who you are or kind of, I guess, markets to what you like. And that means that we all see a different internet. Which I think most people kind of know, but it's hard to remember that when you are searching or looking for certain things that we're all served up different stuff.
Yeah, well, it's also easy to forget that as an English speaker, that the internet is not English. The internet is many, many different languages, but I'm always served English on my internet. That's very useful to me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, it's a weird, I mean, the only time I really come across it is YouTube comments. When there's no subtitles to a song or whatever that's not in English, and then people in the comments reminding others that the world is not in English.
Or if you use like a Tor or a VPN, then you'll end up on a site and it's all in French it can be quite jarring. And actually a lot of the ads then you can ignore because they're in a different, or you don't understand the text of them at least, which is quite refreshing.
I think maybe a big danger, there's still an idea that the virtual and the real world are separate.
Mm-hmm.
That's less so with our generation and even less with the younger ones, but I think I'm on the cusp of people who have an in real life and then a internet world that they do things on and don't affect each other, or they have different personas for each. Like, I was of the time where you would not use your real name on the internet. You had a handle. But I wonder what effect that starts having, say, for virtual reality, where, as you were saying, everyone sees a different internet. But if we walk out on the street, barring perception and literacy, we all have to share the same space. Visual space, and that's going to change with virtual reality, especially if we have augmented reality overlays. We're going to be in the same space but no longer sharing the same space, in the same way that we're no longer sharing the same internet. And I wonder about that.
Well, I guess it's also who owns your augmented reality set. And that's what
interesting
prejudices do they guess that you have that they'll continue to show you.
Yeah, because you could really, like, if you were Pauline Hanson and you thought White Australia was the best thing, then you could actually just only, you could set it to only see white faces when you're walking on the street.
Mm.
Your world really becomes, you have ultimate agency, and enough so that it's harmful to you and your life and the people you have to share the world with.
I mean, I guess then you start to have this gradient, or I don't know, different groups of people as to how willing they are to see things that that disturb them. One participant in this in the show said that Facebook delivers a lot of left wing news to me because I'm left wing, but ultimately, that's going to make me feel like the world is fucked and I don't care, there's so many things going wrong that I'm probably going to withdraw politically. So that's actually the outcome for, you know, if the NSA or Murdoch Press is trying to make me take less political action, then actually showing me more terrible things about the world is probably going to have that action. So outcome. So the question is whether showing us, but whether people can decide whether they want to see stuff that disturbs them and to what extent.
Yeah.
And I guess those kind of algorithms are being worked out over time through constant feedback as to what people like and don't like, how long they linger on a certain ad, what they click through to, sort of forever defining and redefining who we are and what we like in a kind of quite a subconscious way as well. And that's what Selena Nemerin last night was talking about, is trying to kind of grab you in that nanosecond between the subconscious decision making and the conscious, I think I will click on that kind of thing. And she said in her dissertation, she talked about that being a infringement on privacy and on your, you know, we talk about privacy in terms of infringing on the rights of your data, like your computer or your phone, or definitely your house. That's a, you know, that's a well-established private space.
Yeah, which is interesting with the project that Dan's doing with his movable house.
Yeah.
And he's, because, yeah, I spoke to him about, like, the house is exactly, some people give different, like, the not under my roof kind of mentality is understood and respected, that once you cross a threshold into somebody's house. But then there's this, Dan's whole project is that there's a whole generation that are being pushed out of the possibility of home ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you only have privacy in your own home, but you can't afford a home, then actually you can't afford privacy.
Privacy can be rented though, can't it?
Well, maybe not if it's not your owned home. Like, that's up to the landlord and landlord rules and laws.
Yeah.
But it's interesting where these projects start to intersect, I think. Quickly, because I don't want to rush you. That's a weird, yeah, contradiction. Can you draw us a line if we zoom out a bit? You're like, there's these other things I've done, and I guess like invent some kind of linearity. Because I do think most linearity is invented.
Yeah, well, one of my tutors when I did my master's in design in the Netherlands said, you don't decide to do things, you just do, and then you look back over your shoulder and you look what you've done, and then you make up something about what you do. And that's definitely true. Yeah, I think I've actually only realized in the last week or so that I think a lot of my work revolves around the differences between the benefits of something to the individual or to the greater society. Like, would you be, are you willing to stand up for the right of people to have something to hide when you yourself don't? Or what would you do for the state or for a group of people that you wouldn't do for yourself? And I think that in our very individualistic society, also relating to, I guess, Dan's work with individual ownership and that kind of thing, means that we are always tossing up between whether something is good for ourselves or good for the society.
Did individualism start with interior walls? Was it harder to foster individualism when everybody was always sharing space?
Maybe. I mean, I must admit, I haven't really done...
No.
Yeah. Potentially, I guess...
Because individual machines, I remember having a shared computer that the family would use.
Yeah.
Until adulthood, actually. And it was in a public area of the house.
Mm-hmm. Me too, yeah.
And that, so that's definitely impacted how I use the machine and what I left on there.
that's a big thing about mobile devices as well.
Yeah.
That now companies can see what your... They know, very few people share mobile devices in, say, the Western world. And Australia has one of the highest smartphone saturation. I think apart from places, of the Emirates and some of Scandinavia, we're in the top six countries in the world.
Go Australia.
Go Australia. So, and even friends who've come here from South America and stuff, they come back and then they say, oh, I'll wait to get a smartphone in Australia because there's so many, the people just have them in their top drawer. I can, get one for no money. The people just often give them away. Mm-hmm. So, that individualization of technology definitely brings that idea of the individual. But often even with this idea of AI or our kind of idea of how we take political action, do we do things for ourselves or for others? And how much are we willing to inevitably, I guess, give up of our own freedoms or beliefs in order for those of the other? And I think that that's a really, I mean, I'm still kind of working out how that, how I can apply that linearity to all of the things I've done, which I definitely can't, but yeah, trying to work out how, yeah, how what I think benefits me could also benefit society, or am I being, I guess, selfish in that way, or am I giving up for other people?
It's also a weird thing to think about. Are we undermining our power and potential to disturb and disrupt and open what we think is a more beneficial conversation by not using these same tools with this same level of sweeping pervasiveness in people's lives? Like, shouldn't we be hacking the targeting ad systems to implement and serve up the kind of message of your show?
Well, I have done that a bit.
Great.
So I sent out these ads, which were targeted ads. So it was like, okay, the ad on Facebook read, "Hi, 30 to 34-year-old female living in Glen Iris who's interested in marathons and swimming. How do I know this about you?" Because targeted advertising is everywhere. Come see this show.
That's beautiful that Facebook is happy to sell you that possibility.
Well, yeah, but the funny thing is, the more targeted you go, the less people see it. So it's kind of like this funny balance. I was changing the settings a lot through Facebook, trying to work out how to make it specific enough so it was scary enough.
Yes.
And that's a really hard thing to do, because if you say, "Hi, 30 to 34-year-old man, how do I know this? Da, da, da," then it's not nearly as scary as a more specific likes, interests, and but just by saying it, I guess you show it. But there's only a limited amount to how much you can disrupt in these kind of spheres. And as you said, it's not really in Facebook's interest to let you do that. But I guess.
But it's interesting that like that they don't feel like their business model is threatened enough to need to refuse your business. They're like, yeah, people can know about it and we'll still do it and people will still let us do it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe they just took my money and then didn't show it to anyone.
Because you can't know.
Yeah, you can't know.
How interesting.
I mean, maybe I can know through looking at their reporting system, but yeah, I think because also, I mean, Bruno Latour as well talks about black boxing, that you have, we increasingly have smaller and smaller appliances that do more and more things, but we know less and less about what they do. It's all hidden in this black box. Mm. Like the smartphone is the ideal example of this. Mm. But also with internet systems, like, I don't know, whatever services you use online, you don't see how they work. It's all invisible. It's all behind the scenes, and you have very little agency or capability to change that or affect that.
Yeah.
So we're losing a lot of power and agency in these sectors that we use more and more and rely on to be what we think is impartial, but really they're not. But we assume that they are. To a certain extent until we find out that they're not. So, and it's impossible to, yeah, I guess you have to use all technology with certain skepticism until you know how it works, and know how it works as to the best of your abilities. It's interesting with, I think I was reading about the Amish, how they adopt new technology, and how, just kind of paraphrasing, but how they decide, they give, if someone suggests, okay, I'd really like to start using mobile phones, they say, okay, we'll give you a 3-month trial period, but you have to, you can only be so objective about it, so we'll recognize you will use this and be subjective about your feedback on it, but we'll also assign three or four people around you to analyze how you change when you use this technology, and in 3 months we'll assess it. So they look at how you use the mobile phone, how your behavior changes in other spheres, And at the end of those 3 months, they work out how the community can adopt it, or should they? Which means that certain things, I think now Amish can use certain modes of transport to get to certain types of motorized transport to get to certain places, or I think solar panels and power has been used in certain places. I think areas such as music have been really tried to be kept de-technologified or whatever. Yeah. There, so it's interesting that to have such a skeptical approach to adopting new technology that we really don't have in our kind of more developed Western idea of technology.
I wonder if the disintegration of mass media will actually assist in the disintegration of, what was it you said, like 17 or something types of
70
people,
yeah,
70 types of people. It actually, even there's an excellent comedy podcast called Power to the People, and he usually just rants about political things. He's like working out what his show will be, and so he's got a few topics and he works it out, but he just records like riffing on that. And he was talking about how quickly somewhere like Wangaratta versus the Gold Coast would turn into their own peoples and cultures with their own traditions and belief systems if mass media and government failed, and that you would start to, like, there are, that it's mass engagement and saturation of the same content that keeps us similar enough so that we can become one of or a few of these 70 demographics.
Mm.
But actually, as the internet continues to splinter it and serve us what we want, that individualism will undermine the ability for demographics to exist.
I would think that... no, I think it would increase the... How do I say this?
The severity of the difference.
I think that... well, for instance, mass media... So many people now get their... if we say that most people get their news from the internet...
Mm.
Then we can say that that news is served up to them not by newspaper organizations anymore, but by, say, I don't know, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Google.
Yeah.
And now all of those systems have algorithms which will preferentially treat certain news.
Yeah.
Both Twitter and Instagram used to be, you just see what you see. It's this like rolling feed of whatever's happening right now.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, unfortunately, Twitter, which was probably the last one which is really holding on to that, is now deciding what you see and putting advertising in there. So, if, for instance, on Facebook at any time, there are... 1500 articles that you can see at any time, and 300 of them are they show you 300 of them.
Okay.
So you see about a fifth of whatever there is to offer. So I would say that the mass media now is those more kinds of those more kinds of organizations, and I would say those 70 demographics, people from, say, I don't know, 95-98% of society are being pushed into those demographics by this kind of forced reshowing of certain things that you might also like.
Mm.
I mean, 70 is still quite a few, but I think there will still be always the outliers of the 2-5% who get their... Who are outside the box.
Yeah.
And not everyone in those 70 demographics is exactly going to fit into that, because, yeah, of course, you can still seek out different things.
Yeah, but you have to seek it out.
Exactly, yeah, because it won't be served up to you. So I think for the large majority of society, especially as people who grew up with the internet continue to rely on it, and maybe those more Luddites or sceptical people start to... fade into the background, or you know, we move on to the next generation, which is internet natives. That will be more and more. There will be a splinternet, but it will be splintered into 70. And then there would be this small kind of remainder of people who do think differently, and they will always think differently, and maybe there will always be those people who include those people who decide never to be on the internet. I think that's where it's going. It sounds a bit skeptical and a bit negative, but
I think we're going to end up with a complete collapse of the user interface, and I don't think that we're going to know when we are and when we are not using a connected digital network. In the same way that it's just very clunky now, that if there's a piece of information you want to know, you have the thought, and if you haven't already experienced it or learnt it, then that has to activate your hands, that activates some keyboards, that activates some server that brings it back, and then you have to read it through your eyes, and then you know the information.
So really, the pub quiz environment is going to be the last place where knowledge is not immediate.
Yeah.
Everyone, please take off your virtual reality headsets.
No, but even that's kind of weird, because then you have to read it. Like, the ultimate is that you are able to remember things that you haven't actually already learned. You have a question.
That's going to ruin pub quizzes everywhere.
Everywhere. It'll ruin so much. But yeah, you'll think like, I wonder if I can eat that berry when you're in the bush or whatever. And then you'll know. And you'll know either because you had already been told by somebody, or you'd already read it in a book, or because you are connected. But the user interface is like a clunky in-between that will disappear. Do you want to finish with one last question?
Sure.
What is your biggest hope?
Hope's a funny one, because it's kind of like something that you think won't happen, but that ideally would. I hope I die before pub quizzes are ruined.
Good, that's a good one. I guess for all of your efforts, because there's a lot of other shit that you could be doing with this life force and white male cisgendered educated privilege, but you're putting your efforts towards this, and I guess I assume that there's a hope attached to that.
Well, like, one of the things that came up in this is that through the development of this show was that people were like, yeah, awareness is great, people need to be made more aware. And I was like, fuck awareness, people need to actually fucking do something. So that's why, both in the show and in the symposium which happened last night, was that people were like, you know, could actually go and do stuff, like install stuff on their app, on their phones, or on their you know, change settings on their apps, or go talk to these people and actually do stuff there. So I think actually doing stuff and slowly, firstly, having like the fear of God put in them, and then secondly, being able to do something about it was a big thing.
Awesome. I installed an ad blocker, not for privacy, but because I hate ads. And I think a lot of people don't realize that you can install an ad blocker, because most people are not technologists. They're just using another tool. Like, most people are not actually interested in rebuilding cars, they just want to get somewhere, and so they'll take the word of their mechanic or whatever. And that's why you put your husband on the phone to the mechanic. And so I wonder if, like, what that step in between is going to be. Is there going to be a monetization of implementing privacy protocols on your devices? You buy it from the shop, and then you also take it via the privacy shop on the way home, and they install all the things for you. You just get it done. Is that a market that we're missing?
Because
people don't want to do it themselves. They don't want to worry about it. Exactly what you said. Awareness is not the problem.
But I think in some ways the pain that you have to go through, like, often people talk to me about this moment, like, say on Facebook, where they have this kind of glitch moment or this freak out moment when they've, I don't know, been searching for something and suddenly there's this ad front and center, and you're like, whoa, they really are listening to me. Or even something more freaky, like this thing I talked about earlier about the Facebook app using a microphone to record conversations. That freaks people out. And hopefully, I guess, to be able to translate that freak out moment into a moment of doing something about it before that fades. Because I think you actually have to react to stuff that goes wrong to be able to do something about it. And yeah, maybe the slackest solution is, yeah, handing over your phone to a guy at Vic Markets who kind of installs all this stuff for you.
And fixes your screen.
And fixes your screen at the same time. And maybe your volume button as well, because that's a bit sticky.
I wonder about the inevitable end point. So it used to be that if you ran a shop, you were somewhere cold, you knew that people always had jackets, you would start selling jackets.
Yeah.
You're getting a feedback loop of, like, so you can target your products and ads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just been ramped right up to where we're at today. But let's not assume, in like the way that we do with evolution, that we've reached an endpoint. It's going to keep ramping up, and I wonder where it gets to.
Yeah, I guess, like you said, with virtual reality, that it's instantaneous. That maybe, like, I think it was with ASOS in the fashion brand in Europe, the shipping was free, and it was also free to send it back. So there was no barrier to, if you wanted to try something on you saw online, you could buy it and have it refunded with no worries. And therefore, there was no barrier to buying something and having it sent back. So actually, if you, in conversation, in that model, if you said, oh, I need a new dress for this wedding I'm going to, then maybe when you get back home that afternoon, ASOS has sent you a dress, that if it doesn't fit, that you could send it back for no cost. Actually, maybe a nice point to end on was to talk about a project I did called Money Back Lunch, where I was on a residency in Bratislava, in Bratislava, and we made a project where we went to all of these businesses which gave your money back if you were unsatisfied with products. You get your money back within, I think it was 30 days or whatever. So we bought cooking equipment, we bought food, we bought knives, we bought all fancy clothes, all on a credit card, so that we could, in the morning, and then we went and cooked everything, used everything, kept all of the packaging in the exact same spot, kept all the tags on all of the clothes, and at the end of the day, took everything back and said, oh, we were unsatisfied, or we, yeah, so we ended up kind of returning these kind of things. So it's, I guess, these little hacks that you can do, which address the ease of transferal of money or goods, which help to create this, like, shift in thinking about why it's delivered and how, and the ease in which it changes our lives. As you said, with information before, but with the transfer of goods in order to be able to advertise, you know, what's advertising but a conduit between thinking about something and purchasing it? Well, if that's taken out of the equation completely, then maybe that's where target advertising is going. Yeah. Oh,
that's a great ending. Wow. Great.
Cool.
Thanks.
No worries.